Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today's topics, fraud and food. In a minute or two, we'll hear from Jennifer Taub, who'll trace the roots of the 2008 financial crisis to the savings and loan mania of the 1980s, and then we'll hear from Margaret Gray on the exploited workers behind all that nice farmers market food. Before we begin, a hybrid apology complaint. People are cutting their landlines like crazy. This is hard on a radio producer who does a lot of phone interviews. Skype can be good, but it isn't always, and cell phone signals are almost always worse than landlines. I do the best I can, but sometimes the reality falls short of my aspirations. I'm very aware of this and wish the audio were as clear as Waterford. It's not always. Sorry. My first guest is Jennifer Taub. Taub, a professor of law at the University of Vermont, is author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business, just out from Yale University Press. The use of thrilling in the subtitle is a nice touch. Back in the old days, mortgage banking was a dull affair, dominated by savings and loans. They'd take deposits from regular people and use the money to fund 30-year mortgages, which they'd keep on their books for all three decades. Some people got rich, but for most participants, it was a sleepy business. Starting in the 1970s and accelerating majorly in the 1980s, however, it turned into a hot business. No longer did S&Ls keep loans in their books. The model became one of loan production. Make the loans, few questions asked, package bunches of them into bonds, and then sell them via Wall Street banks to institutional investors. It got truly insanely reckless, culminating in the 2008 financial crisis. But the roots of the story in the 1980s is often forgotten. Jennifer Taub does a nice job remedying that oversight. One of the things I really liked about your book is that you start back in the, well, actually with the deregulation of the late 70s, but things really got going with the savings and loan crisis of the early 80s. That's largely forgotten now, it seems. But start the story for us there. I mean, what are the roots of the recent debacle in the experiences of the late 70s, early 80s?
Well, I see that the entire toxic mortgage-backed chain was enabled by incremental acts of deregulation and desupervision. So there, when most folks look at the financial crisis, they begin the story with either the run on Bear Stearns in March of 2008 or the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September of 2008. And by doing so, they're ignoring the key point that this most recent financial crisis began as a mortgage crisis. And so in looking at the mortgage crisis then, for those who look at that, there is also an unfortunate tendency to point to so-called subprime borrowers as being the folks who got us into a mortgage crisis. So the story that gets repeated over and over again says that there were people who couldn't afford to buy homes and had no intention of paying back their mortgages, duped sophisticated bankers into giving them loans, and then defaulted. And with this story, somehow we then get to a banking collapse brought on again by these subprime borrowers who fooled these sophisticated bankers, and then we needed a multi-trillion-dollar bank bailout. And that story is obviously something I'm trying to debunk in my book, but in order to actually look at the root causes, you have to go back and ask, well, why was it that, number one, folks were given mortgages that they couldn't afford? They, of course, didn't trick bankers into it. These mortgage loans were pushed on people at higher rates and on terms that they eventually could not afford. And in some cases, people who already owned their homes but were pushed into loans that stripped their equity and their savings from them and left them homeless. So that's one part. You have to say, well, how did that happen? And then the second part is, how is it that the default on home mortgages led to a massive banking crisis? It wasn't just the failure of these mortgages. It was the way that banks were highly leveraged themselves and had loaded up on mortgage-linked securities and placed a whole bunch of side bets on these. So those two pieces of the elements of the recent crisis were enabled by decades of deregulation that began back in the 1970s.
Yeah, I recall a Wall Street Journal sort of look back, roundup, thumb-sucking piece after the savings and loan disaster, probably late 80s, early 90s. And the phrase that I remember is that it represented the criminalization of the nearly the entire professional class of the United States. Now, well, I'm not quite sure I would use the word criminalization, but there were just so many people involved in private and public life in producing a disaster of this magnitude that it's hard to, you have to have a lot of fingers to point.
That's true. So just kind of going back to the savings and loan crisis, and just to make this point, what I argue in Other People's Houses is that the 2008 crisis was really just a repeat of the same disease that causes savings and loan debacle. And you mentioned the criminalization of an entire industry. What happened in the late 1970s, early 80s, is that the savings and loans were failing, not at first due to anything that the owners or operators of the savings institutions were doing, but because of these exogenous shocks. So in particular, we were undergoing massive inflation, and to tame inflation, in October of 1979, Paul Volcker, who was then chairman of the Fed, decided to essentially let interest rates flow as high as they might. And as a result, when interest rates shot up, what happened to the savings and loans is that they faced imminent collapse. And this is because they were carrying, you know, the savings and loans were set up just like George Bailey's Building and Loan in It's a Wonderful Life. Their whole purpose was to take in savings and channel those in mostly into mortgage loans. And it was a pretty simple business. They made money on the spread. So you have mortgages that pay you more than the interest you have to pay out to savers. You keep your overhead low, and it works.
Yeah, there was the old 3-6-3 rule, right? You take deposits at 3%, lend them out in mortgages at 6%, and you're on the golf course by 3. That was the old S&L industry.
Exactly. It was kind of a no-brainer business, and it served communities, and it helped get people into homes and the like. But what happened when interest rates spiked is that the S&Ls had to pay their savers much higher rates than they were bringing in on those mortgages. They were on a market value basis hugely insolvent. And so there was this moment we're now at the end of the Carter, we get into the Reagan administration. So there's this moment of this transition between these administrations, sort of it was late 1980 and then later in 1982 under Reagan, when the industry clamoring for help from their regulator, the federal regulator, and from Congress, says we need help and gets this huge deregulation program through. The theory was, let's let them grow out of their problems. Let's let the savings and loans get into all manner of asset classes, not just making mortgage loans, but building loans and even junk bonds. So let's loosen them up on what they can do with the money that they bring in. So that's sort of the asset side of the balance sheet. But also, there was allowing them to bring in big quantities of money through what was known as brokered deposits. So instead of just you and me and, you know, moms and pops taking our savings and putting it in the local savings and loan, channeling money in huge chunks and huge sums into these savings and loans, and then, you know, again, taking that money, not loaning it for mortgage loans, but into supposedly higher yielding investments to make up for the fact that they were losing money due to the interest rate environment. And this led to, this is where the criminal element came in, because the model for the federal deregulation of savings and loans came from some of the states, including Texas, which had deregulated its savings and loans in the 1970s, and they had been showing huge profits at first, but a lot of that was built on a kind of Ponzi scheme type financing project, which began to collapse in the mid-1980s, shortly after the federal deregulation.
One of the things that was so impressive about reading your book is that there are 30 years of unlearned lessons. You keep saying the same things, you know, variations on the same mistakes or crimes happening over and over again. So you early in the book, you talk about, was it the I-30 corridor? That I'm getting my highway right. What happened there?
I-30 is a sort of east-to-west corridor north of Dallas. And there was a developer who's still famous around those parts, Danny Faulkner. And he had been successful in building a small condominium development on a lake called Lake Ray Hubbard. It was called Faulkner Point. And he and his son made some money on that. And he thought, okay, well, I want to go big now. Let's build these more condos. And because of Texas deregulation of the savings and loans, instead of savings and loan only being able to, you know, to loan for home mortgages, it could make loans to this guy Faulkner and his various friends. And they invested in a savings and loan, which was located in a small strip mall with, you know, not much in terms of assets, maybe, you know, 13 to 16 million in assets. And they, what they are able to do is bring in hundreds of millions of dollars through broker deposits coming in from the Northeast and channel them into this condo development project without focusing on the fact that the condo market was already overbuilt in Dallas and that this whole plan was nearly impossible to carry out given, you know, the lack of a demand for finished condos and the fact that they were selling these condo development kits to people who had no experience building. So it was a terrible process. The thing that made it corrupt and ultimately criminal, however, was where the real money was is the bank would loan money to people like Faulkner and others who would buy up parcels of land. These are the parcels upon which they plan to build the condos. And they'd buy it for a small amount of money, then go out and sell that land, flip it over and over and over again in a single day. You know, they'd set up a long table in an office building, and they would sell, they'd flip that same parcel of land until it was pumped up many, many multiples of the original price. And each of those loans from, you know, essentially straw buyer to straw buyer was bigger and bigger and bigger, financed by the same savings and loan.
Yeah, that was incredible. It was like speed dating. You just go from one table to the next, right, and flip it at a successively higher price. Who was the chump at the end left holding the bag?
The chump at the end left holding the bag was the taxpayers, because ultimately this bank, the Empire Savings and Loan, was the first savings and loan to fail due to fraud during the savings and loan crisis and ultimately needed to be shut down by the federal SNL regulator, which at the time was called the Federal Home Loan Bank Board.
It seems, you know, reckless on the face of it to allow a real estate developer to own a bank and lend himself money for development. Yet we did that hundreds and hundreds of times during the savings and loan mania.
It does, and yet it's one of these things, and you see it again and again with banking regulators, that they are pressured or believe that when you see an institution thriving, that you really can't look any further because if they, you know, they would be job killers or hurting success. Because, of course, in the way these schemes work is that everything, when loans are made to a developer for, let's say, a piece of land well above the land's value, as long as a loan is big enough to make, to leave some money in the, you know, money in there to make the initial payment, it doesn't all fall apart until the very end. And so there can be a period of months or years when the bank looks like it's doing very well. They also engaged in there are these schemes called cash for trash. So if you had a bad loan on your books, let's say you were a savings and loan and you loaned to someone for a parcel or for an office building and the office building was sitting empty and the loan wasn't performing, you would sell that loan to somebody else. Let's say a borrower who came in who just wanted to borrow, you know, $1 million. You might, if you're a corrupt savings and loan, say, okay, you know, I'm not going to loan you the $1 million to do that addition to this building, or to help start up a restaurant. I'm going to loan you $20 million, and you're going to use some of the proceeds of that loan to buy my bad loan from me. And so everything, you know, was a form of cooking the books and accounting fraud. But what I'd like to also say with the savings and loans, you know, there were a lot of corrupt folks at some of them. But in some cases, the corruption came from above in that part of helping the savings and loans look better was a whole new accounting scheme called regulatory accounting principles, which I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but it was a way to try to make these balance sheets of these savings institutions look stronger than they actually were.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Taub, author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business, just out from Yale University Press. And the process, let's pivot to the more recent history now. The process was so similar in the housing bubble, in the sense that we had not merely a lack of regulation, but even regulators encouraging the mania. People sort of aware of what was going on, but averting their eyes, hoping things would take care of themselves. So you had this regulatory forbearance then and more recently. I mean, the parallels between these two cases are striking, yet the scale, of course, in the more recent one was even larger than the first time around.
Many of us are struck by the comparison. In doing the research for the book, though, what I found out is that it wasn't just similar to, but we literally have the same institutions, in some cases the same individuals, that failing again. And so I mentioned that the regulator for the federal savings and loans was the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. And when George Bush Sr. Took office after Reagan left, so in early 1989, he began a really big cleanup of the savings and loan industry and some measure of re-regulation with a law called FERIA. And one of the first things that he did was to supposedly abolish this terrible regulator on the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. But really, most of what happened was just a name change. It became the Office of Thrift Supervision, the OTS, which is, as you may recall, famous for being the regulator of the biggest savings and loan that failed, or the biggest, actually, depository institution that has failed, which was Washington Mutual. And the OTS, that renamed regulator, was also the regulator for AIG and for IndyMac and for Countrywide. So we see that. But on the other side, it's not just looking at the failed regulators, but looking at the failed institutions. In the book, I focus on the largest savings and loan that failed during the SNL debacle was an institution called American Savings and Loan, which was bailed out and became a new entity called American Savings Bank. And American Savings Bank gets bought out by Washington Mutual, which then we see fail again. We also have individuals, various individuals, folks who worked at the Federal Home Loan Bank Board that loosened up on the savings and loans that would fail, and also in some instances looked the other way with SNLs like Keating's Lincoln Savings and Loan. And some of those actual people, individuals, end up working for the Office of Supervision and become later involved in similar shenanigans with the institutions that failed recently.
It was remarkable to read that quote from Alan Greenspan. You know, people talk about regulatory arbitrage, where institutions get to choose their regulators, that being the easiest one. Greenspan defended that as a defense against overregulation. I mean, the man's capacity to make mistakes is remarkable.
Greenspan really is a piece of work, and is in some ways the star of the financial crisis. I mean, if there was any silver bullet, he had it. As chairman of the Fed, he had the authority and the leadership to use a federal statute called HOEPA to end some of the worst underwriting practices that helped, create the toxic mortgage-backed housing crisis.
A couple of other things I want to cover. The fact that homeowners could not file for bankruptcy and have some of their mortgage debt relieved, how did that come to be?
The term cram-down, which is a pejorative term, but refers to a homeowner being able to go into bankruptcy court, and if they owe more on their mortgage than their home is worth, if they're underwater, being able to restructure that loan so they only have to pay back the amount relative to the value of the home. That's sometimes called principal reduction, or it can also be called cram down. So that used to be done in bankruptcy courts between 1978 and 1993. In 1978, there was a new law called the New Bankruptcy Code that replaced an older one. And this law was interpreted by many bankruptcy judges to allow cram down. In 1993, however, with a case called Nobleman versus American Savings Bank, the Supreme Court stop that practice. And in the book, I decided to dig into the past of the nobleman family, Leonard and Harriet, who were the petitioners in that case, as well as American Savings Bank, which I've also just recently mentioned with you. So the thinking behind this is there are two different parts of the bankruptcy code that are in tension with one another. When a business files for a reorganization in bankruptcy, it's Chapter 11. And when a consumer files, they call it Chapter 13. And the idea of both Chapter 11 and Chapter 13 is to deal with the fact that there can come a point in a business's life cycle or in a person and family's life when they simply are no longer able to pay off all the debts that they have incurred. And the purpose of restructuring is to allow a business or a family to get a fresh start and to pay off those loans that get priority in full, and then to pay in part or perhaps almost nothing for the remaining loans. And this has been bankruptcy law has been a tradition in the United States. It's authorized under the U.S. Constitution. And with consumer bankruptcy, when you go in for a reorganization under Chapter 13, one provision of the code does something to separate or bifurcate creditors' claims. So it treats what's known as a secured creditor, a creditor that essentially has collateral to back a loan, different from an unsecured, which simply has a promise to pay. So in the case, let's use an example of a boat. If a creditor who loaned someone money to purchase a boat, if the loan was for $50,000, but at the time of the filing, the boat is only worth $30,000, then under the bankruptcy law, you bifurcate the claim so that lender has a secured claim for $30,000, which is up to the full value of the collateral, and has an unsecured claim as to the $20,000. And so the bankruptcy code allows bifurcation, and that creditor will get paid in full for the 30, or it allowed to, if it won't get paid in full, could take the collateral. And then it can stand in line with the rest of the unsecured creditors with the 20. And under a restructuring bankruptcy, the consumer comes up with a plan to pay back their debts over a 3 to 5 year period. So that's how it would work. Same thing for a vacation home. However, when it comes to a primary residence, there is this other part of the code. And this other part of the code says that if you secured claims on a primary residence, on a first lien, so just your regular, your first loan, not your home equity line and so on, but that a secured claim on a primary residence, so a secured mortgage, can't be altered by the judge. Now, why were courts going ahead and allowing cram down before 1993 was they were applying that first section of the code first. They were looking at a mortgage holder and saying, okay, they owe you $300,000. The house is now only worth $200,000. You're a secured creditor with as to the $200,000. You're unsecured as to the $100,000. And let's look at that $200,000. Yes, the homeowner has to pay you, and we can't alter that, but you will be paid. You'll be paid out the $200,000. According to how the loan works, and we won't alter that, but we're going to go ahead and alter the unsecured part. And that was happening in jurisdictions covering over 20 of the states in the country until the Supreme Court in 1993 said no more.
You talk about when Obama was taking office, the issue of mortgage relief principal write-downs came up, and you quote Barney Frank saying that Obama gave that away on the way to the Oval Office. How did he give that away?
Well, when he was a senator and he was a candidate campaigning for the presidency, as recently as the day after Lehman Brothers failed, Barack Obama was calling this treatment of homeowners in bankruptcy a Washington loophole, and that he was going to close. He thought it was unfair that a family that owns one home couldn't go into bankruptcy court to help write down their mortgage. And let's just be clear, no one expects every family to go into bankruptcy court when the housing price drops a little. We're talking about, you know, massive collapse in home prices. And even with that, not everybody would file for bankruptcy. The idea is that if you were in distress and you were trying to restructure your loan, you would have more bargaining power with the servicer, because we know what happened with the servicers dual tracking people, saying we're working on a restructuring, but then at the same time proceeding with a foreclosure. If a homeowner had the ability to file for bankruptcy, that wouldn't happen. So going back to candidate Obama, you know, he at big rallies, he said this was something he was going to fix. But then you might recall that right around after Lehman failed was when Treasury Secretary Paulson and others were asking the Congress to authorize the $700 billion blank check at the time for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and it didn't get through Congress. And there is a bit of a crisis at the moment. And around that time, John McCain announced he was suspending his campaign and he was going to rush down to Washington to try to help. And right around that same moment, candidate Obama spoke with Harry Reid and others and with Nancy Pelosi and told them privately that they should drop bankruptcy reform. And it was dropped. And the sense that housing advocates thought was that there was either an explicit or implicit promise that that if he were elected, he would take care of this when he got into office.
But he didn't. Okay, and finally, have we learned anything? Has this gigantic crisis finally changed the way we think and act, or are we poised to repeat the same mistakes in the coming years?
Let me start with the good news. The good news is we now have a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and I think that's an excellent development. And it's already taken some good steps to stop the kinds of really predatory mortgage underwriting that we saw. However, in terms of a bigger picture, there were incremental improvements made to make the financial system somewhat safer through the Dodd-Frank Act and its implementation. But unfortunately, it's not safe enough. And I don't think we have fully learned our lesson, unfortunately. Leverage at the giant banks is permitted to be just as high as it was before the crisis. The large banks are still relying heavily on short-term financing. So just like the savings and loan relied on broker deposits, which were very fragile from a financing, our big banks may rely on another form of very short-term wholesale funding, the same kind of funding that brought down Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. So that is still continuing. So there's much more work to be done.
And we've gone from a situation in which we have banks that are too big to fail, as some people say, now they're too big to save.
Well, we shall see. I mean, the largest banks are now substantially larger than they were before the crisis, but now we're being told that that size does not matter, that they're no longer too big to fail because of this new resolution authority is what it's called in the Dodd-Frank Act. I'm skeptical.
That was Jennifer Taub, a professor of law at the University of Vermont, and author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business, just out from Yale University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. That was some of My New House by The Fall. Next up is Margaret Gray. She teaches at Adelphi University and is author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic from the University of California Press. The food movement has gotten people thinking about purity and sustainability, but not so much about the workers behind the offerings at the farmers markets and farm-to-table restaurants. That tomato may be organic, beautifully pedigreed and fresh, but it's quite likely that the workers who raised and picked it are miserably exploited. Here's Margaret Gray with the story. We hear a lot about being sensitive in our food consumption habits, which means buying local and looking your farmer in the eye and all those sorts of things that Michael Pollan et al. Have made rather famous. But the reality behind the farm stand is considerably less pleasant than it might seem, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I think what happens is that the local food movement has largely neglected discussions of the labor conditions on the farm, while giving great attention to animals and the environment and to farmers themselves, really not address the concerns of the workers.
You focus on the Hudson Valley, which is region just north of New York City that is the crucial conduit for supplying farmers markets and CSAs and farm-to-table restaurants and all that. It's an unusual agricultural history. It's rather different from sort of larger scale industrial agriculture elsewhere in the U.S. Right? It's been shaped by a different set of forces than more familiar large scale farming.
Sure. Yes. There's a long history of tenant farming in the Hudson Valley, and of course, then these incredible rent strikes to dismantle the tenant farming system. And at the same time, the sort of pre-yeoman farmer in the Hudson Valley is the Jeffersonian democratic ideal. So I think that in addition to really epitomizing a local food system, the nostalgia and the history steeped in the Hudson Valley itself, along with this incredibly gorgeous landscape, really all these get wrapped up together to promote farming in a way that harks very much back to Jeffersonian ideas about romantic agrarianism and how farming is the primary unit of a democratic system. And the updated version of agrarianism, of course, is that this is a very wholesome occupation. And we know the food writers like the Michael Pollans and the Barbara Kingsolvers, they've given us a great education on the benefits of local food and how animals can be treated better. The pesticides will be applied with much more diligence, or we can get organic. And of course, we're keeping food dollars local. And I think in the food movement conversation, when we look at all these benefits, and then the conversation doesn't include anything about workers, I think it's very easy for the consumer to jump to the conclusion that the conditions for workers in the Hudson Valley are also better, that fit with these other ideals very nicely.
Who constitutes the workforce up in the Hudson Valley? I mean, it's relatively recently evolved into a largely immigrant workforce, but give us the history of the composition of the workforce over the decades.
Starting with World War I and World War II, there was real concern about labor shortages on New York farms. So there were workers essentially imported. You had Canadian workers coming down from Newfoundland to work on farms. But you also, this is when you had the first guest worker programs from the Caribbean and also from Puerto Rico. And as you see a shift in the dynamic, because then the returning soldiers who come home, of course, many of them don't come home, but those who do come home from World War II often move into an urban setting. So agriculture really gets transformed and the need for labor is very much increased. And so early in the 20th century, very early on, you had a lot of white ethnic migrant workers coming from New York City in particular. But then by the 1940s, you largely have an African-American workforce coming up from Florida, as well as laborers being imported from Puerto Rico and from the Caribbean. And this is very unique on the East Coast because, when we think about the West Coast, when we think about the middle of the country, we certainly think about Mexican workers. And it's not until the 1980s that New York really sees a shift to a Mexican workforce and a Latino workforce. So the primary workforce is people of African descent in New York. And then in the 1980s is when the shift really takes off. And by 2000, I've seen some statistics that put the Latino workforce at 75% of the farm worker population. And today, the people I speak to say that it's continued to gain speed. So the primary workforce really is non-citizen Latin American workers. But New York also does bring in guest workers, about 3,000 to 4,000 guest workers a year, primarily for the apple harvest. And many of them are still from Jamaica.
Why the shift to Latinos?
I think there are many factors that work into it. What farmers will tell you first and foremost was that black workers were no longer interested in agriculture. And to some extent, there's some truth in that, because over so many decades, you had the children of migrant farm workers becoming migrant farm workers themselves. But the benefits of the civil rights movement really shift that. So that in the 1970s, you have fewer children of migrant workers wanting to become farm workers themselves. So in some sense, there is a lessening of the population of black workers. At the same time, as your listeners very well know, whenever you have a tightening labor market, it means that workers have more power. So the remaining workers who were there, it was easier for them to demand higher wages, to not put up with abusive conditions or even just the speed with which they were expected to work. And so farmers started to look for other types of workers. And this is at the same time that you have the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, which offers an amnesty program. So then you have Mexicans from all over the country who've been involved in farm work coming east, and then they themselves start to become middlemen and recruiters for other workers. And what farmers told me was that they thought that a lot of the black workers were just too lazy and didn't want to work hard, and that the Latin Americans had an incredible work ethic. Now, of course, that's the story of ethnic succession. That's an old story. When farmers got a little bit more specific, they told me that the Latin Americans were great because they were not Americanized, and that as soon as they were Americanized, they wouldn't become good workers, be as good workers, and that as soon as they had a good grasp of English language skills, then again, they would start acting like Americans and be lazy workers. So farmers were pretty clear with me that the Latin Americans were desirable, and largely they put it in terms of because they work so hard. I didn't have that many farmers go on to make the extended argument having to do with them being much more vulnerable. You know, some of them looked at these workers as just a new generation of immigrants trying to make it, and that's an old story that immigrants come to this country and sacrifice. And for a lot of farmers, they know that the money they pay their workers makes it home and puts floors in houses and indoor plumbing and pays for schools and pays for medical expenses. So I think for farmers who probably don't want to always imagine a level of exploitation, it's easier for them to rationalize the wage differential between what someone could make here in New York versus what they might make back home in Michoacán. But, you know, the bottom line is really that the Latin Americans are just more controllable and easier for them to work with.
Yeah, when employers say they just can't find the right work ethic in the workers, it means that people don't want to work extremely long hours doing arduous work for almost no money. I mean, that's really what they're talking about. Let's talk some about the work itself. I mean, it really is extraordinarily arduous. The hours are very long, right?
Yeah, so I met a fair amount of workers who really worked extensive hours. Now, you know, I did meet workers who told me they worked 80 to 90 hours a week, and I didn't really believe them. They told me that they were up at 6 in the morning and out in the field, that they went home for lunch for about an hour. They went back to the field, had dinner in the field, worked until it was dark, and then made their way back to the packing shed to pack everything for going to market the next day. And I said, you know, I calculated, I said, well, this means you're working in the packing shed until 10, 11 o'clock at night. And they said, yeah, and sometimes later. These workers were logging 80 to 90 hours a week, many of them being paid about 50 cents over minimum wage. Farm work, there's no requirement that farmers have to pay overtime pay. So they can really just make they could be paid minimum wage for an 80 or 90 hour work week. I would say most of the workers I spoke to did get a one day off a week, but almost all of them were working at least 6 days a week. It's backbreaking work. There are no OSHA regulations that says, oh, it's too hot, you can't work outside, or you need shade. They just don't exist. So in both extreme heat and extreme cold, and a lot of repetitive motions, because one of the benefits of local food, of course, is that we're not getting food from monocrop ventures. We're getting these diverse farms supplying to us, but that also means that you really need the hand application of labor. Bending over, cutting squash with a really sharp implement, and then going to try to pick blueberries, which can be really tedious and hard on the fingers, and it's a lot of difficult hand labor. And, you know, the other thing that a lot of people wouldn't even think about is the workers feel like they have to work at a pretty extraordinary pace. And it's not as much of a problem for men, but for a lot of women, it means they might watch how much they drink during the day because they don't want to have to take a bathroom break. Because to walk to the port-a-john could be a quarter mile walk down the field. And, you know, that would be a lot of lost time there as well.
American labor law, of course, is not very very worker-friendly, but it's especially so in the case of agricultural workers, right?
Yeah, so this is a legacy of the New Deal when FDR was passing those great labor laws. The Southern Dixiecrats, they just didn't want their workers to be included. So domestic workers and farm workers, who were largely the African-American workforce in the South, they were excluded from these rights. They were also excluded from Social Security, but that was later included. And most states around the country continue the trend and have adopted in their state constitution the same rules. There's no requirement for farmers to pay overtime. There's no requirement that they give workers a day of rest, and they don't have collective bargaining protection. For someone to really imagine what the conditions are like, you have to take into consideration that these are largely non-citizen workers, whether they're undocumented or they're guest workers, and they're really afraid of losing their job, and they're afraid of being deported.
The New York State Department of Labor does not play a very inspiring role in this story, does it?
You know, not in the story I've told. So what I found with the New York State Department of Labor was that Department of Labor did a lot of recruitment for farms. And so one thing that would happen would be that they would favor Latino workers over African-American workers or Caribbean workers. What workers would see was that a Department of Labor representative, and they had a special rural representative division, the workers would see these representatives come to the farm every year. And the first person that the rural rep would talk to would be the farmer. They know these farmers year after year after year, so they have a pretty comfortable relationship, whereas some of the workers would only be there 1, 2, 3 years. So the workers often saw the Department of Labor rep as working with the farmer and not working with the workers, which, yes, is not very inspiring. But what I would say is that I've heard in the past couple of years, since I submitted the manuscript, that the rural division in the New York State Department of Labor has been revamped to a certain extent and has been changing their practices to better cater to workers. So that's really good news. I don't think workers have seen a major transformation just yet, but there are changes taking place.
A bit about the farmers. Are they raking it in or are they just barely getting by? What is their economic situation?
To some extent, you're really talking about a marginalized capitalist class relying on a marginalized workforce. There's incredible diversity on these farms. So when you go to a farmer's market, you might go up and actually it could be the farmer there selling the goods to you. And that might be the only farmer's market they sell at. So I certainly know a farmer from the Hudson Valley who's in this situation. He comes to one New York City farmer's market. He comes down himself and he's got two workers back up in the Hudson Valley and he's struggling to get along. But some of the people who are setting up stalls in these farmers markets, they're going to 10, 20, 40 different farmers markets around the state. So some of them are really mid-sized firms with anywhere from 40 to 80 workers. I don't know whether to say that they're raking it in, but a fair number of them are down in the statistics, but bringing in $600,000+ a year. So I think they're doing okay. I think the problem for the consumer is it's really hard to tell who's who when you get to the farmer's market. And most of the time, we like to imagine that these are all pretty small operations. So there's a great amount of diversity in the farm.
That sentimental idea that you're looking your farmer in the eye when you're at the farmer's market doesn't have much grounding in reality.
No, especially in New York, because so many of the people who are selling at the farmer's market, they don't even work on the farm. They work in New York City, and they come and they sell the produce at the market after it's been delivered here. I think that the Michael Pollans of the world, they are nostalgic. I mean, Michael Pollan has even called the farmer's market possibly the new town green, right? The center for a civic society to take place. But let me give you an example. I was talking to somebody who's involved with the New York Green Market, and someone was doing a book signing at the farmer's market. And I was talking to her and I said, oh, wow, would I be able to do a book signing here at the farmer's market? And she said, well, I'll look into it. But, the activities we do here are largely to promote the farmers and to promote New York agriculture. So she actually hasn't gotten back to me about the book signing. But I think, it's way too easy for us to fall into this trap that somehow the farmer's market is the new town green in that way. And we need to be looking at these farmers as business people who are really concerned about what their profit's going to be. And that said, I think we all have an understanding that there are incredible pressures on farmers. We know that food costs in the U.S. are so low compared to other developed countries. And I know that farmers that I spoke to talked about the pressures they feel from the housing developers, the pressures they feel because their neighbors in the Hudson Valley are not sympathetic to the spreading of lime, which they think is a pesticide, or to irrigation machines running. So, and there's no doubt in my mind that a lot of the farmers are marginalized and very much feeling marginalized. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not also engaged in exploitive labor practices.
And of course, most consumers are worried about what they eat, whether this stuff is safe and or full of chemicals. Really, the condition of the workers that produce the food is really generally not much of a topic of interest.
No, but you know what, Doug? I think 15 years ago, we didn't really care where our chickens came from either. You know, if you went into a restaurant 15 years ago and there was chicken on the menu and you said, could you tell me what farm this chicken is from? You know, someone might look at you like you had three heads. And I think that's where we are right now with the labor conditions. So I think one of the hopeful elements of this is that the food movement in so many ways really has been an education campaign. And if the food movement can turn a little bit to start including workers in the conversation, I think some excellent education can go on and consumers can start to be primed to ask questions about the workforce. And then farmers will start to know that that consumers are concerned about workers. When I spoke to farmers and said, you know, what kind of questions do you get at the farmer's market? How many do you deal with? You know, they told me about the range of questions they get asked, and nobody could ever recall being ever asked a question about their workforce.
Can anything be done to improve the lot of the ag workers without state action?
Yeah, well, so the Coalition for Immokalee Workers in Florida has set up a rather incredible model that exists outside of government. They're the ones behind the Penny for Pound campaign that have the agreements with some of the major fast food restaurants and also with some of the major catering companies around the country. And what they've done is they've been able to get that one penny per pound sent directly to the workers themselves. And many workers have seen an increase of 30 to 40% of their wages. In addition, they've set up a third-party education and monitoring organization, which then has farmers engage in contracts with them. So if a farmer wants to sell to one of those major fast food or catering companies, they have to agree to certain conditions. They have to agree to trainings and inspections. But what I want to say is that in Florida, there is no State Department of Labor. In Florida, the politics are such that there really was no vehicle by which these farm worker advocates could go toward government and toward a policy change. And I've spoken to the people who run the Coalition of Immokalee Workers Penny Per Pound campaigns, and they've even said to me, the scenario is different in New York. New York is largely a Democratic state, and here the public and consumers and voters can make a big difference. And in 2010, there was legislation that's been introduced for more than a decade, that's called the Farm Workers Fair Labor Practices Act. And what it would do is give workers the overtime protection, give them the day of rest protection, give them collective bargaining protection. And when the leadership finally let it go to the state Senate, the floor of the Senate, for a vote, it only lost by 4 votes. So, you know, many of the farm worker advocates are hopeful that change can occur through government here in New York, whereas an understanding that in a place like Florida, you know, they're a long way off politically from being able to consider this type of legislation.
That was Margaret Gray, author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic, from the University of California Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a song that expresses my relation to the country life, Train Round the Bend by the Velvet Underground. Till next week, bye.